Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com.
The F-35 program is history's largest single defense program, with three variants of a common stealthy jet to replace a number of legacy combat aircraft. Some 650 aircraft have already been built and are operational with the United States Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, as well as a dozen other nations, while the F-35's combination of stealth, sensing, and data fusion are proving literally game-changing, including against real-world adversaries. The program has recently been criticized by none other than the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Adam Smith, as well as the Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force, General C.Q. Brown, for being more costly to operate than planes it's replacing, along with criticisms that it's underpowered, experiencing combat systems problems, and suffering from spare parts shortages that are continuing to contribute to lower than expected availability rates. More vexing, critics say, is that several hundred older aircraft may be too costly to upgrade to be operationally useful. Joining us now for his first one-on-one interview since becoming the F-35 program executive officer is United States Air Force Lieutenant General Eric Fick. Sir, thanks very much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here today, Vago. Thanks for asking.
It's an honor and pleasure to be having this conversation. It's one that I've had with every F-35 PEO since the inception of the program, and remember having covered when it was originally born.
Before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report, and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, our coverage of strategy, and General Motors Defense, our technology coverage. And please check out our Cavas Ships podcast with none other than our contributing editor, Chris Cavas, and our producer, Chris Cervello, who talk about global naval developments on a weekly basis.
You have arguably one of the most difficult jobs in DOD. You've got to be organizing and managing the world's most complex and largest defense program. What's your mandate, and what does success look like on this program?
Thanks for asking, Vago. So I consider success in this program really to have three basic components. I need to deliver a capable aircraft, I need to deliver an affordable aircraft, and I need to deliver an available aircraft to my joint and international warfighters, and I need to do that each and every day at a level that supports their warfighting commitments, not only now, but 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 40 years from now, 50 years from now, before eventually we roll the last one off to the boneyard. So it's that mandate from a capability, availability, and affordability perspective that I feel are really my guiding lights as a PEO and program director. Taking the goodness of the program today and understanding that goodness won't last as we look off into the future, right? From a capability perspective, we're crushing it. It's doing really, really well against the threats for which it was designed. But we know that 10 to 20 to 30 years from now, we're going to face a different threat set, and we need to continue to evolve those capabilities. Same thing with affordability, right? We know how much it costs today. We are taking deliberate action to move those costs in the right direction so that as we move off into the future, we'll reduce the cost and increase its relative affordability. I'll say it that way.
Right.
And then finally, from an availability perspective, you know, it doesn't do us any good if it sits on the ramp. So making sure that we are energizing truly a global network to sustain the aircraft, to take care of both the immediate degraders to system availability, as well as the long-term fixes that will keep us from just kind of having a flash in the pan recovery and turn that really into a sustainable global repair and sustainment network.
How do you respond to critics? Why do you think this program is still relevant?
Quite honestly, I think that we bit off a lot with the F-35, especially when you consider that we started chewing better than 20 years ago, right? With an extraordinarily complex system, three different airframes, common mission systems, common, you know, support type equipment, but with a mandate to bring them all to life. In full disclosure, we did it, right? At the end of the day, the F-35 exists today in the fleet and is doing what it was designed to do in some pretty significant numbers. Yeah, as you mentioned before, close to 650 airplanes out there doing their duty. The capability we bring today I have characterized as game-changing, and I'll stick with that analogy. From a game-changing perspective, it's like bringing Tom Brady to your peewee football game, subbing him in off the bench, and that's how we play today. We know, however, that as we move off into the future, those peewee football team members are going to grow, and they're going to get better, and they're going to learn from Tom Brady, and they too will become better athletes. They'll close the gap, which is why we need to continue to get better. But even in that goofy kind of a analogy, we all realize that we don't play football alone, right? We always have teammates. So in my mind, when I look at the other developmental efforts that are ongoing within the services, when I look at the Navy or the Air Force's version of a next generation fighter platform, when I look at B-21, I look at them as teammates. I look at NGAD as my Gronk. I look at B-21 as my Edelman. I see this as a team effort as we go into battle together using ABMS or Overmatch or JADC2 more broadly to link those communities together in a way that allows us to win for the next 50 years. I don't see the F-35 as becoming any less relevant, but I see it continuing to be that quarterback of an integrated joint force that's going to be what we will require to defeat our enemies in the future.
And I think that that's an element that's always lost on people as they look at it as an airplane and a replacement for what are legacy aircraft, whereas its capability is quantum-fold, better in its intelligence gathering capability, its ability to fuse data, and its ability to affect a battle even if it doesn't shoot anything in terms of its unique attributes. Are you concerned with the F-35 narrative as it's been unfolding?
I am a little bit concerned with the narrative. When I hear things like the aircraft isn't performing, right? The costs are continuing to bloom. Those things I don't necessarily feel are particularly helpful, nor necessarily true, right? As I look at what the aircraft is doing in the field today, again, could it be better? Yes. But do we have our arms around the program moving forward? Also, yes. You know, when I looked at the GAO's recent report and the narrative that the costs have increased, what I find missing in some of that narrative is the notion that we extended operations of the fleet by 13 years, right? We extended the number of aircraft in the fleet by a small fraction, but we still increased the number of aircraft. So as a result, the number of aircraft years increased by close to 10%, 8%, and the number of flight hours for the family, the system, increased by on the order of 5%. So when we consider that cost increases over that baseline set in 2012, we have to make sure that we recognize that, you know, in addition to some cost growth in some places, the program has grown too. The full extent of the program has grown.
How do you sway the critics on this program? Because it would seem to me that some of the people who criticize it have actually been fully briefed and know all of the capability and the right answers here, right? At the end of the day, how do you sway the critics, and when are you going to sway the critics so that people just go, hey, wait a minute, this is the train we've got now and we have to make it a success, as opposed to being like, oh, hey, look, what's the next VCR? You know, I'm not going to buy the next VCR. I'm going to just have 12 flashing on it until I get rid of it. Nobody will understand that joke, Emma.
Anybody remembers that except you and me. Great question, though. I think I can't. You know, go back in a way back machine and change decisions that were made in the past, nor will I critique my predecessors for tough decisions that had to be made to allow the program to continue to move forward. But certainly, you know, decisions to defer spares and decisions to defer the stand up of organic maintenance, for instance, have had long reaching impact on the program. Sensing that, hearing that, realizing that, you know, we elected to put it increased dollars into spares. We re-accelerated, if you will, the organic depot stand-up so we can get back to a place where we start to make that happen a little bit more quickly. But in terms of swaying the critics, Vago, all I think I can do is to deliver. right? I talked about capability, availability, and affordability. I have a mandate to deliver those things. Those are closer to within my control than anything else. But making sure that the Block 4 capabilities deliver, that TR3 cuts in Lot 15 like it's supposed to. I continue to drive cost out of the program. And you see that through decreasing cost per flying hour, right? When I look at my 19 to 20 actual cost per flying hour, I don't have all of the numbers yet, but for the Air Force F-35As, I decreased that in constant year $12 because those are still the baseline dollars we use. Decreased it by close to 10%. That's pretty substantial. I also know that when it comes to availability, we're not where we need to be. But are we moving the needle in the right direction? Absolutely we are. We're attacking the near-term degraders while simultaneously doing the longer-term things we need to do, like making sure we've got spares, making sure we've got the depot capacity to turn around the carcasses of the reparables. I think my mandate is simple, and it's to deliver on those promises. I can't enter a conversation about what ifs because that won't actually get anything done. But I can work to deliver, and that's what I'm going to do.
How do you answer to critics that are worried that those earlier block airplanes will just have to be, quote, thrown away or operationally not useful, right? What happens to this fleet as, for a lot of combat applications, you know, you've got your newer airplanes that do the break in the door stuff. How do you see the fleet sort of ending up, given that you're trying to get to that Block 4 standard and you have a lot of airplanes now that are not Block 4 and a lot that are 1 and 2?
Yep. So again, great question. And that is a conversation that we are in the middle of at a very, very deep level with all of our services and all of our partners. As we look at, obviously we have everything from Lot 1 to Lot 13 aircraft in the field. We know that we want to bring most of them up to a Lot 15 TR3 kind of configuration, many of them up to a Lot 17 full Block 4 kind of a configuration. And we understand at a pretty granular level the costs associated with updating or upgrading each of those platforms. And really, the conversation with the services becomes, what are the mix of missions that we need these aircraft to execute? How many of them do I need to be full up Block 4 and beyond? Quite honestly, we're going to have another conversation, I will argue, 10 years from now, about which of these aircraft we upgrade to a TR4 configuration, right? And then 10 years after that, maybe another conversation about what it means to upgrade the aircraft to a TR5. And hopefully, as we do this, we do it in a way that makes each of those block upgrades easier to actually execute. But your first point, though, is we understand that the cost to upgrade earlier lot aircraft to that full configuration is a little bit more, and the cost to upgrade call it a lot 12 or 13 aircraft obviously is a little bit less. I can't tell you what the final numbers will be from a service-to-service perspective or a partner-to-customer perspective, but we're in the middle of those now. And I don't think there's any intent to throw away airplanes, I'll put it that way. But perhaps the question becomes, which of these aircraft will now just become training jets, or which of these aircraft will enter the test fleet and stay in that kind of a configuration until their time is up.
And very quickly for our audience, sort of talk to us a little bit, because you talked about Block TR, just so that the audience can follow along. Unless, they're real F-35 junkies, they might not be following along exactly with what you mean.
As we characterize the roles and missions that the F-35 was designed to meet, the Block 3 or the 3F configuration that we're building today, that was really the first developmental version, what was designed to go after a certain set of threats. As I mentioned before, we're doing really well against those threats today. We realize that threat environment is going to change as we move off into the future. And so to address that threat family, if you will, we developed the Block 4 capability set. And so the Block 4 capabilities broadly are roughly 69 individual capabilities with a whole bunch of enabling capabilities underlying them that allow us to go after that evolved threat. And those are capabilities that are what I would characterize as hardware enabled but software defined. In other words, those are capabilities that not all... In other words, not all of those capabilities will run on the legacy Tech Refresh 2 hardware that is really kind of the brains and the guts of the F-35. The Tech Refresh 3 hardware set that will be required for us to field all of the Block 4 capabilities consists of an aircraft memory unit, a panoramic cockpit display, and what we call the integrated core processor. Those three elements together, combined with the other software that goes into them, are what give us the true Block 4 capabilities that we'll need to go after that next generation of threats.
In terms of numbers, right, volume has always been critical for this program, whether it's from cost per flying hour or a unit price standpoint. About 2,400 U.S. jets, about another, you know, couple of hundred international airplanes, so the program's around 3,000 jets. That would make it a massive success by any accounting. But you're increasingly hearing folks in the services, including your own service, talk about trading, you know, hey, we can trade a couple of hundred F-35s in order to get more B-21s when that decision comes due as the service looks to expand its bomber force, bomber fleet, recognizing range, persistence, payload being things that are going to be very important in the theater. If this program ends at 1,200 or 1,500 jets, it would still be an astounding success for a combat aircraft program. Look at Eurofighter or Rafale or the Swedish Gripen. Does this program succeed and survive and thrive at 1,500 if it's not 3,000?
So that's a great question, too. Certainly, I think that the service chiefs and all of our international partners, as they assess their warfighting requirements and as they assess the funds that they will have allocated to them, need to make a decision relative to what their forces need to look like. Does that mean that the Air Force will buy all of the tails that they initially said they would, that the Navy will, that the Marines will, that any of our international partners will? I don't know how that's going to turn out, but I know, you know, that's their mandate, right? If I were Chief Brown, I would be having the exact same conversation to figure out, you know, what are my commitments? What will my commitments be for the next 50 years, by the way? And what do I need to do to fulfill them? So I guess, you know, when it comes to the program being a success or not, I think about the capability in the aircraft that the chiefs and that the nations eventually ask for. And in my mind, the success, you know, quantity has a quality all its own, right? So I understand that there are reasons to have large numbers of aircraft. But at the same time, I think the success of this program comes in what it enables for the joint and coalition warfight, for what it enables for, you know, the fourth gen or fourth gen plus aircraft that some nations and some services may be buying now. What it means to the B-21, what it means to NGAD, what it means to other aircraft and systems, overhead space systems, for instance, perhaps, that might be integrated into a JADC2 kind of arrangement that take the data from the F-35, that high quality data that we can get that nobody else can get, and inject that into the network so everybody can use it. I think the interesting part to me is I don't necessarily think that a decision has to be made right now relative to how many do I need to buy in total. Because I think that independent of what that final number is, or maybe not independent, but pretty close to independent to what that final number is, we still need to buy at rate for quite some time to get to the place where the chiefs and the other nations need to be.
You know, you mentioned something interesting about JADC2 and how the program links to the fundamental approach to warfighting that we're constructing. Do folks recognize the role F-35 is playing in JADC2? Because it's the F-35's capabilities that actually shaped and informed what JADC2 will look like, or the advanced battle management system that the Air Force is working on, or in fact, indeed, the advanced synthetic environment we're trying to build, because the things that you do, you can't really test in public given adversary capabilities and being able to report it. How key of a linchpin, and do you think people fully appreciate the role that this program is serving in spurring the state and driving the sense of the state of the art in sensing, airborne computing, as well as connectivity, the likes of which we really haven't experienced before?
I think the warfighters understand it. I think increasingly the 11 services and 9 nations that have declared IOC, the 6 services and 5 nations that have actually employed in combat, I think they understand exactly what the F-35 brings to the fight. I don't know that everybody does, but maybe they don't have to. They just need to trust that those who are flying and fighting with the system get it. And that those are the ones who need to be looking at what does that long-term plan look like? What does that long-term joint and coalition war fight look like as we work to continue to provide a blanket of peace worldwide? I read this morning, I think it was General Walter's comments that talked about 450 F-35s in Europe by about 2030. And I know that only a small fraction of those are going to be U.S. F-35. So there is a blanket of F-35s stretching from the Arctic Circle to the Mediterranean, providing security, providing warfighting capabilities with complete interoperability with U.S. forces as early as 2030. And that's a remarkable number and a remarkable presence literally around the world. That I don't think you get with any other platform or any other system.
Shout out to both General Harigian, the USAFE commander, and as well as Magoo Walters, because they've sort of understood the power of those fifth generation air forces can play, especially for deterring and shaping, and especially when the Russians understand that the introduction of a triple digit SAM changes the game and really makes it a little bit harder for us to deploy fourth generation, fourth generation combat aircraft. That I think that people have a tendency of not recognizing. You don't always have to be fighting, as Mike Wynn used to point out. You know, his brother wasn't killed by the Soviet Union; it was killed by the best equipment the Soviet Union could furnish to the Vietnamese with which to shoot down American combat aircraft. So I think that folks are understanding that lesson. Let me ask you a question about agility, because I think even the Block 4 standard is something that you could argue is the great power variant of the airplane, right? It's always had great power capability and tendencies, but that is sort of the sharpest end that we can deliver now. And speed and agility are two things that are said and bandied around now and becoming increasing priorities, right? The chief talks, I think, rightly about accelerate, change, or lose. I've been dedicated most of my career to making that case that we could be a lot more agile. There's the tendency of looking at the F-35 as sort of an old school, sort of big and cumbersome program. But actually, you spend an extraordinary amount of your time on briefings, on oversight, on handholding, on diplomacy. And how much faster can this program move? Because there's a tendency that says, like, it's big and bulky, and so it has to move like an elephant, and it can never be a gazelle. You know, we have to invent it from scratch to be a gazelle. How much faster can this program move to adapt to threats and to actually deliver capabilities? Because everything about the program has actually been moving quickly in smaller bites that might not be as obvious to people. How much faster can you move this? Because in your career, you have moved some very, very important and highly classified programs at extraordinary speed.
Yeah, I think if push comes to shove, we can move very fast. And we've done that with some of the capabilities that we fielded already in Block 4, right? We fielded Auto GCAS. I think we accelerated that by on the order of 4 years to field that in one of our early Block 4 releases. And we have the mechanisms within the program to quickly energize the governance structure to allow us to pull requirements in, to allow us to apply funding, to allow us to deliver on very short notice. When I first came to the program, just over 4 years ago now, we started having discussions about how we increase the cadence of delivery of capabilities to the warfighter. It started with the understanding that we can't deliver Block 4 in Big Bang fashion. That in order to make our timelines, which are long timelines, but in order to make those, we really had to deliver it incrementally. And so we started this agile transformation and the instantiation of what we've called the C2D2, or Continuous Capability Development and Delivery process. We were initially targeting 6 months software releases, doing development test and fielding in increments to allow us to incrementally deliver those Block 4 capabilities. And in some ways that went well, in some ways it didn't go well. Very recently, we've decided to back off of that cadence to go to an annual release cycle, which is still well inside most other aircraft software release cycles, until we get better as an enterprise in delivering, better as an enterprise in being agile with a capital A and not just a small A. So we're working very closely with Lockheed Martin. We're working with the test community, with the engineering community to look at the things that we need to do to become agile, to adopt the same kind of software development and delivery paradigms that industry has done on, you know, things like your iPhone.
Last question I have for you is sort of a, for lack of a better word, an honesty discussion, maybe, right? Because you do reside at the intersection of all these competing imperatives by everybody, and ultimately, right, are not total master of any of these. You're trying to control what you can control, but at the end of the day, everybody knows that the cost per flying hour of this airplane is calculated differently. At no point has the program ever said it'll be cheaper than an F-16 to fly. It's a low observable aircraft. It has capabilities no other aircraft has. You're amortizing 55 years of cost in this thing from depot maintenance. It's not the radar separate or anything as we've discussed. And people involved in the debate know that. You've communicated to them what the cost per flying hour per jet per year is, the ownership cost is. And yet, it's not up to you whether they adequately budget for that or budget less for that and then become very disappointed that they may not have enough money for that. What's the lesson here in terms of how to do this and do it right and set the programs up for success?
Certainly, it's hard to reach unrealistic expectations. Let me talk about affordability just a little bit, right? When I look at affordability, I look at it in two ways. I look at two different aspects. I look at what the cost is, and that's the part that I control, right? I can control the cost, and I can be very transparent and articulate relative to the drivers of cost within the F-35 program. We have conversations, you know, literally on a daily basis with our service counterparts, with our international counterparts on what the costs are, what we project they will be as we move off to future and what we're doing to bring them down. That's one element of affordability. The other element of affordability is the amount that the services and the partners have allocated to use on the F-35. And if there's a disconnect there, that tells me that either we're not communicating well or we didn't plan well perhaps, you know, in the bidding, or maybe the situation on the ground changed, right? Maybe things aren't the same today as they were 20 years ago, and we need to reassess where we are and where we're going. I think, you know, for any program to succeed, you need a couple of things, right? You need stable requirements, you need stable funding, you need short chains of command, you need a willing partners from a warfighting perspective and from a industry partner perspective. And when you bring all those things together, I think really good things happen. I've seen that. I think you've seen that. And I think, you know, making sure that we are communicating clearly with all of those entities is going to be the best way forward to get ourselves, you know, out of the place we're in and to perhaps, you know, quell some of the invective that we tend to hear, frankly, in the media and elsewhere. Right. We need to admit the program's doing amazing things today. It's doing what it was designed to do in incredible ways. Talk to any warfighter. Don't listen to me. Go talk to the warfighters. I think they will tell you that. We're bringing costs down. All right? We know it's expensive. Warfighting is an expensive game. But we are bringing costs down each and every day. Each and every one of my program management offices is working to drive costs down. And we're working our tails off again each and every day to drive up availability. As we work together as an enterprise to get after those three mandates, communicating our status with one another as we go, that allows us to both speak the truth about what we have and about the challenges that are still in front of us so that we can go after them together. You know, pitting ourselves against one another is not gonna help in the long run. So I am in, my JPO is in, the enterprise is in to work these things collectively. It's the only way we're gonna get past it.
Is there going to be continued international support for this, and have some of these statements undermined international support for the program? And do you think that some of those international partners that are considering the plane, whether it's Canada or Finland, have been dissuaded at all by some of these statements?
So I don't know if Canada or Finland or Switzerland think about what they formally think about the program as they work their way through their source selections, because we're not privy to those. But as I look across the partnership, I think each of the international partners and each of the foreign military sales customers that we're working with are very committed to the program. Very committed, and I haven't seen that commitment wane as we've marched forward because of the capabilities that we bring to the fight. They are very demanding customers, by the way, very demanding partners, very demanding services relative to driving performance up and to driving costs down. I guess I would articulate that they share the same perspective with respect to those three mandates that the U.S. services do. So I don't personally see any waning in the demand signal. But I know that the mandates that they hold for us are the same that the U.S. services hold.
And very briefly, HMS Queen Elizabeth, flagship of the United Kingdom and the Royal Navy, Hayes Gray, and underway on its first deployment with, I think it's what, 10 Marine Corps Bravo jets, as well as 8 combined Royal Air Force from the Dambuster Squadron, but Royal Navy pilots are also involved in that, and not just the Royal Air Force. An extraordinary deployment, U.S. ships supporting it as well. Talk to us a little bit about the deployment and some of the lessons learned.
Thanks, Valgo. I'm really excited about this deployment. So first time we have put U.S. F-35s on a foreign flag vessel, certainly partnering the Marine Corps with the Royal Air Force and Royal Navy folks aboard the Queen Elizabeth is a great learning opportunity from an employment perspective, but also from a sustainment perspective as we work to understand what it means to operate either in close proximity or to actually cooperate aboard that ship, literally traveling around the world on it as we speak. So I'm excited about the opportunity it brings. It highlights the interoperability, the coalition warfighting enabling capabilities of the F-35, and I think it's indicative of continued great things to come. For what it's worth, we also have 2 or 3 additional international exercises ongoing, again, as we speak, with Air Force, Marine Corps, I think Israeli and Italian F-35s all playing together. It's growing. If there were a takeaway I'd have you take out of this conversation, it would be that the F-35 is no longer something that's on the horizon. It's something that's here today. Well over 600 aircraft in the fleet, close to 650, I think. The sun doesn't set on the F-35 Enterprise. Literally, it wraps the world. And we're delivering those game-changing capabilities as we speak. We know we need to get better in certain places, and that's our job. And so we're going to get after it.
Sir, thanks very much. It's an absolute honor and pleasure, and I absolutely love that UK F-35 tie-in on the sun never sets on the F-35 Empire. Thanks very much again. Looking forward to continue talking to you about what has truly been one of the most amazing programs I've ever covered. Thanks very much and best of luck.
Thanks, Valgo. I appreciate your time today.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir, and thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.